A warm welcome to the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action. My name is Anna Tritschler. I am communication lead at the Center for Humanitarian Action. And today's guest is my colleague, Goda Miller-Schutte, who is a research fellow at CHA. I invited her because I'd like to talk to her about one of the key projects in the current CHA work plan. Intermediary financing mechanisms, such as the much-discussed pooled funds and their potential to enable and anchor local leadership. Welcome, Goda.
Thank you.
Goda, you're just back from a research trip to Ukraine. Actually, as part of your research, you've traveled to Ukraine a couple of times. So before we get into the specifics of your research, perhaps you could start by sharing with us, where exactly did you go? What did you do there? How was it different from the last time you went there?
Sure. So I went to Kyiv a couple of weeks ago as part of my research on local leadership within the Help Localization Facility, or the HLF, which is a funding mechanism which passes funding to local humanitarian actors in Ukraine. And as its aim, there is less bureaucracy and more access to funding for local Ukrainian humanitarian organizations. And besides funding, the HLF also aims to shift decision-making power to local civil society in Ukraine. So basically, my research looks at this aspect. And so in Kyiv, I spoke with representatives of organizations which are funded by this mechanism, also the experts who are part of the HLF governance structures, and also some localization experts in Ukraine. And of course, the situation in Ukraine remains very difficult. And yeah, I'm more so grateful to everyone who spoke with me, who took time and energy to speak with me, despite the Russian attacks, the constant attacks and air raid alerts, constant witnessing of loss of life and loss of critical infrastructure, sleep deprivation and other difficulties. And then in a relatively short time, you always hear lots of good work that people are doing and even inspiring stories. So I think I'm very impressed by all the work that people are doing in Ukraine. And my research is evolving as the HLF is evolving, so to say, so because it's currently being piloted. So since the last time that I was in Ukraine, the organizations which are funded by the HLF, through the HLF, they have started their project implementation. So I was very curious to learn about the process and their partnership with the HLF as a mechanism. And of course, in Ukraine, the situation is changing a lot as well. I don't know, this time since I went in spring here, a lot of people told me how difficult this winter was, because the last time I was there was beginning of winter. So yeah, with the electricity cuts, the lack of heating, in some cases no water. So yeah, you feel this a lot also, even when you go for a short time. And also I'm Lithuanian, so I feel very emotional going to Ukraine and working with the Ukrainian context and with people there. And yeah, there is a lot of solidarity there.
I can imagine. Yeah. Okay, so maybe when we now look at your project, what you do is you look at the local leadership in funding mechanisms and want to identify criteria that can be used to assess to what extent financing mechanisms are locally led. Maybe to start with, could you explain to our audience what different financing or funding mechanisms are there in humanitarian action?
Sure. So maybe I can start by saying that there is no strict definition of what a quote-unquote funding mechanism is. So in my current research, I use it as a kind of umbrella term to include both pooled funds, the multi-donor pooled funds, and other types of funding facilities like the HLF, for example, which I just mentioned. So these funding mechanisms, they can be hosted by different types of actors. So they can be hosted by local actors. For example, there are local pooled funds, or they can be hosted by international actors, like, for example, NGO-hosted funding mechanisms like the HLF, or the UN-hosted mechanisms like the country-based pooled funds. Mm-hmm. So funds and funding facilities are also not the only type of the so-called intermediaries. So maybe I can just kind of zoom out a bit and say that So the funding, I mean, most of our listeners probably know that, but the humanitarian funding doesn't, in many cases, doesn't go directly to the implementing organization, but passes through some other actor, so the so-called intermediary actor. And so these intermediary actors can either be these funding mechanisms that I just talked about, or they can also be, for example, single organizations, and also then in that case, different types of single organizations. So in this case, it's the so-called bilateral funding, or also it can be a group of organizations, for example, a consortium of organizations mm-hmm. or a network. So yeah, I hope that makes sense.
Yes, it does. So as part of the latest reform agenda, the humanitarian reset, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, UNOCHA, has called for 50% of global humanitarian funding to be channeled through these country-based pooled funds in the future. So why is this such a miracle cure? Can you tell us?
So maybe I can start by saying that I don't think that it's a miracle cure, it depends. So, I mean, pooled funds have the potential to improve humanitarian action. So they have the potential to enable more flexibility of funding, because this funding is not earmarked for specific areas, like in the cases of bilateral funding. Mm-hmm. Or this funding can be more predictable, because funding is collected in a, so to say, common pot. So there is less fragmentation than in project by project donor funding. Or related to that, there is the cost efficiency aspect. So the transaction cost might be reduced. And I think what is really important also in the case of pooled funds, that pooled funds are or can be a platform for diverse actors to get together, to coordinate, to collaborate. And so the people who are also closer to the context, to the crisis context, are also or might be part of the structure, which then might also lead to, I mean, in effect, more effective humanitarian aid, because people who are closer to the context, they are part of the decision making. In this sense, or related to this, pooled funds are also often discussed as a means to remove barriers to locally led humanitarian action and to have more local representation in the pooled fund structures, or to pass more funding to local organizations. So in that sense, pooled funds can offer new opportunities in terms of both broadening the donor base and the variety of organizations which receive this funding. But yeah, as with all things, the devil is in the details. So the questions such as who has access to the pooled fund funding, and related to that are all the application and due diligence procedures. So these questions have to be considered, and also who makes the funding allocation decisions, according to which criteria, who decides on this criteria, and who selects or maybe nominates or elects the decision makers within the pooled funds. Then how the strategic decisions related to a pooled fund are made, and by whom, and many other questions have to be considered to kind of answer the question if it can be a miracle cure or to make it into a cure. And also maybe last aspect to this, I think it's really important to keep in mind that the UN country-based pooled funds, while they have some comparative advantages, they are not the only pooled funds that exist out there. And there are also NGO-led funds, including local pooled funds, which have their comparative advantages as well, such as the ability to pass funds to smaller grassroots local organizations. And so on. So in my view, a diverse intermediary ecosystem is really important.
You also mentioned that not only access to funding, but access to quality funding is essential. What is meant by that?
So the quality can be kind of translated into the timeliness dimension. So in the sense that the funding should be multi-year, if possible, so that organizations can plan and continue their work. And the flexibility is another aspect, which, as I mentioned, pooled funds have kind of that advantage to enable more flexibility, also for organizations to set priorities that better reflect the humanitarian needs, especially for local organizations, since we also talk about local leadership. And also, yeah, it is really important to mention that the flexibility of funds is not adequately passed to the end recipient. So it's really important to keep in mind in like all the intermediary structures and also in the pooled funds, how this flexibility of funds can really be kept throughout, you know, the funding, when the funding travels. And another aspect related to the quality of the funding is funding for overhead or indirect costs beyond the project funding to ensure the organizational sustainability, especially for local organizations, so that organizations can also kind of plan ahead and not worry about their survival.
In your first research output, you write that when designing a funding mechanism, considerations of power dynamics among different actors within its governance should be central. How can local leadership be ensured in the mechanism's design?
Yeah, so I think it's a really important question. And I think so, because one area is the design. We often talk about the kind of the projects which are funded through a mechanism, which is, of course, really important. And also, you know, the access to funding and so on. But the design of the mechanism itself is really important too, especially because a lot of these mechanisms are hosted by international actors. So then an aim to have the local leadership, at least participation or representation aspect within them. So yeah, I've already mentioned representation. So local actors, of course, should be part of the mechanism's governance. Then also the question arises, which local actors? Because there is a tendency to treat local actors as a kind of a monolith. But of course, it's not the case. As with all the actors, the nuance should be kept there as well. Local actors are also different in size, different in their geographical focus, different in their leadership. There are local organizations which are women-led or led by refugees or other marginalized groups. And they also have more barriers within the system, even among the local actors. So I think it's really important to have a representation of diverse local actors within the governance structures. And then also, yeah, there is the consideration of what kind of powers different actors have within this governance structure. So, for example, donors often have a veto power, which, of course, it's a lot of power. Project review and selection is, of course, a key part of work of funding mechanisms. So there should be diversity in the committees which make these decisions, should include different actors as well. The anonymization of the proposals is important to prevent conflicts of interest. And so that kind of, it's both for the actors who make the decisions, but also the organizations which apply for funding so that they get like fair treatment. And when I say representation, I imply that these actors, so local actors in this case, have actual decision-making power in these mechanisms, because tokenism or the practice of inviting local actors or marginalized actors to kind of check the box is a dangerous practice, because it kind of creates the impression of inclusion, but it's not really meaningful. And I mean, yeah. People invest their energy and time without it leading to some outcome. So to have actors there and to have local actors in these structures and to ensure that they actually have decision-making power there.
Just one question on this. Wouldn't it mean that if local actors are included in the mechanisms, that then they cannot receive any funding from this pooled fund?
I mean, there are also different ways to go about that. So, for example, when it comes to, of course, it's really important to separate the actors who make the decisions mm-hmm. and who apply for funding. So there is a possibility for actors, for example, to recuse themselves from decision making, to, as I said, preventing conflict of interest, for example, declaring mm-hmm. in advance, you know, kind of recusing themselves mm-hmm. from that specific decision is one way to avoid that. It's a fair question. How can you both ensure the access to funding from organizations and the participation in the strategic or funding allocation decisions? I think it depends on the context. I think there are ways to avoid this conflict.
One specific aspect you mentioned is two-way accountability. Maybe you can explain a little bit what you mean by that.
Sure. So, I mean, accountability has been quite a big problem, or the lack of accountability. Accountability is not a problem. The lack of accountability is a problem in the humanitarian sector and when it comes to local international partnerships. So maybe I can start with what happens when there is the lack of two-way accountability. So then there is only the upward accountability, which is reflected in local international partnerships, that's reflected in local actors being accountable, so to say, upwards, quote unquote, towards donors and also maybe some intermediaries. So that's reflected in heavy compliance systems, in upward reporting, in kind of reporting also based on criteria identified by donors or by other actors who hold more power in that situation. So the two-way accountability would mean that it is not only local actors which are accountable or are held accountable by donors, but also that donors or the intermediaries would be, international intermediaries in this case, would be accountable to donor, to local actors, sorry. Some people also call it horizontal accountability, or there are also other ways to describe it. Kind of horizontal accountability would be to avoid this like vertical
hierarchy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is also related to kind of the practice of unequal risk distribution or risk transfer, because local actors are exposed to most security, safety, operational risks while having little control over strategic decisions. And as I just mentioned, reporting to upwards to the donors. So it's a bit kind of like lose-lose situation in some cases. So that, of course, needs to be changed. And risk sharing is a practice to avoid that when it comes to unequal risk distribution. So practices like joint risk budgeting or adopting duties of care. There are some really technical things like rethinking commercial insurance coverage, or what I think is really important, also engaging in not only preventive but also reactive risk sharing when it comes to like non-negligible incidents. And maybe just to add more broadly related to accountability, I mean, good communication channels and feedback mechanisms are really important with clear follow-up procedures, because it often happens that there is a channel to provide feedback, but then it's kind of unclear what happens with that feedback. So a clear follow-up is really important. Transparency related to that, because it's also really difficult to hold someone accountable if you don't know kind of the state of things or what kind of what the criteria is, or you don't have the data to prove that, you know, the standard kind of, or the promises are being fulfilled or not. So that is really important. And if I can just mention one last thing, which I also think is really important, is who sets the criteria also for all this, like what's good work and what's not, what expertise or what's not, what's valid experience or what's not. I think it's really important also to recognize local actors' expertise and also lived experience in this context.
Well, looking a little bit into the future after this first output in your research project, what comes next? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about.
Sure, I can give you a little sneak peek. Mm-hmm. So what will come out now or very soon, hopefully, is kind of a short paper on local leadership through humanitarian funds, pooled funds and funding mechanisms. So in there, I operationalize local leadership according to different, based on different dimensions, which we have also just discussed. Mm-hmm. And the main result of my current research will be a report on local leadership within and through the HLF. So when I say within, I mean the HLF governance, and through, I mean the project funded by the HLF. So this should be published by the end of this year.
One very last question, and this is a question I want to ask all my guests in the chat room from now on. If you could use some kind of magic to stick a post-it note on every humanitarian worker's desk or workstation, what reminder or appeal would you write on it?
Mm-hmm. So I knew that you would ask me this, so I could prepare a bit. And yeah, and I thought about it for a bit. And I mean, you'll find some technical recommendations in my papers. And I thought that in this context, maybe we could all use some inspiration in these times. So I'd like to share part of a quote by Arundhati Roy from her book, The Cost of Living, in which she encourages us, and I quote, "To never simplify what is complicated or complicate what is simple. To respect strength, never power. Above all, to watch, to try and understand." So, yeah.
This is a very nice quote.
I think, I think it's good to keep that in mind.
Thank you very much, Goda.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our listeners for joining us. Tune in also next time to the Chat Room, a podcast on humanitarian action from the Center for Humanitarian Action. If you have any ideas about who we could invite as a guest, or if you have any questions or suggestions, please feel free to email us at info@charberlin.org.